Thank you. So I just want to start out by introducing the RSPCA and what I do at Mallardams. So a little bit of background, just in case you're not familiar. As has been mentioned, the RSPCA is an animal welfare organisation. So as an organisation, we're interested in helping animals and trying to prevent cruelty to animals. On a daily basis, I manage a wildlife rehabilitation centre that admits around 3,000 wild animals a year. And so really what we're doing there is just sort of mopping up the aftermath of animal cruelty, whether it's birds have been shot, gulls have been shot with pellet guns, things have been run over on the road, that kind of thing. But on a bigger scale, what's really important to do, we think, is to try and prevent that happening in the first place. So a really important part of our work is on the education and prevention side of things, and that's what I'll be talking about here this afternoon. So trying to prevent us even needing the wildlife centre, I suppose you'd say, in the long run. And we've had funding to do this over the last few years from the lottery, and so what's been really important there is, you know, measuring what we're achieving on the education project. So our funders, you know, it was a necessary thing to sort of count and measure what was going on and what was happening with our preventative work. But what that started to reveal was a lot of depth and a lot of interesting things going on that perhaps we hadn't originally set out to achieve, and it probably put us out of our depth as an organisation in terms of understanding them. So I will say from the very start, what I hope to get out of this presentation is also some understanding from all of you of what we've been finding, because, you know, it's not always our area of expertise, what we've been looking at and what we're trying to unpick now. So this is really, this PowerPoint is an attempt to describe the findings and our basic reflections on it. However, I will also just point out that you'll see lots of pictures of children. There's only one puppy picture in this, I think. I feel I've let you all down. But on the other hand, organisationally, we've always been all about the animals. But when you think about animal cruelty, where does it really come from? It tends to come from the people. So we're undergoing a sort of a sea change in terms of how we think of ourselves and where we position ourselves. And so I think the pictures that I'll be showing you here reflect something of how we're now understanding that it's the human-animal bond that is shaping how animals are treated and is either the cause or the solution for the animal cruelty that we're trying to deal with. Now this is the really exciting bit. It's our 200th anniversary in 2024, so needless to say, the important people way up the food chain above me have been busy devising strategic objectives. And here's the one that, you know, is guiding everything we do, this idea that, you know, we want to change the opinions of all UK citizens. And actually, when it says UK, that's not strictly true, because we only operate in England and Wales. So that's a bit of an overstatement there. But we would like to persuade everyone that animal cruelty is not socially acceptable, and so on, as you can see there. In the context, you know, that's an important thing, and this overarching objective has the focus on sharing and recognising all of our joint responsibilities. It's very easy for people to say, here's an injured animal, here's a problem, I'll get somebody else to sort it out. The RSPCA can do everything. Sadly, we can't, and often we get criticised when we don't. So our objective is really about trying to make sure that everybody shares that workload with us, but also realises that they can take part in it in a positive way. It's not just shirking our duties, it is empowering everybody to take part in that. And you know, in this picture here, you can see, you know, the sort of the glass wall between the people and the animals. What we want to do is somehow break that down so that people see how they are involved with animals, where animals impinge on their daily lives, and what things they can do to make their own daily lives and perhaps the daily lives of the animals that much more fulfilling. So that's, you know, what we've been trying to do there. In terms of working at Mallardams, which is near Hastings, it's an area of high inspectorate caseload, which translates as there's lots of animal cruelty in the area. And so our focus is on our local clientele, if you like, and trying to work with them in a way to prevent future animal cruelty so that our statistics improve. That's one way of looking at it. But also is, you know, to prevent cruelty happening to animals. And well, how do we translate that into actually doing something useful? Because it's all very well to have these strategic objectives that are, you know, are not memorable things. Well, what we have chosen to think about as our sort of core focus in our work at Mallardams is the idea of empathy, and that idea of helping people to share or, you know, imagine or recreate the feelings of animals in order to understand the position that the animals are in, with the idea that hopefully that will give them a greater sense of how they can help those animals in future. The benefit of this is that actually empathy is not just about animals. And a lot of the families and the children and the young people that we work with have, you know, let's say, a lack of social empathy generally. And so, you know, this is a transferable skill. If you have empathy with animals, perhaps you will have empathy in society as well and be a more productive member of the society. I'm sure that's what big society is all about. So we'll be doing our little bit for them there. But, you know, what we're trying to do really is just give children and young people an opportunity to start to make those connections and to start to have some empathy for animals and for their peers and for the other people that we're working with. And the project that we're running predominantly works with people up to the age of 25. We work with teenage and young parents and their preschool children, and we work with young people usually referred in from, for example, the youth offending team, or who are excluded from school, and other groups like that that we're specifically working with, and sometimes where they've been involved in crimes against animals. So it's quite a big ask to change people's attitudes and opinions. And what we're not trying to do is to brainwash people. I mean, I have been with the RSPCA quite a long time myself, so I am brainwashed, but I don't entirely want to change everybody to that perspective. It's about people making their own choices from an informed stance. But really, there's this sort of continuum, if you like, of being engaged with whatever it is you want to be engaged with or not. And all we would ask is that we'll be attempting to move people from their position, wherever it is, actively disengaged or engaged or passive, further along towards the positive end of the spectrum. For some people they may make a lot of progress along that, for other people it may just be a short amount of progress, but that's what we're overall trying to achieve. There's plenty of literature around evidencing nature deficit disorder, the lack of connection between people and the natural environment, and showing that if you do access nature and wildlife, it's beneficial for mental and physical health and all sorts of other things. There's also a lot of academic literature about you know, how animals are sort of family glue and, you know, are family members and can contribute to the sort of cohesiveness of the family. There's evidence that dogs, you know, are sort of harbingers of social capital, if you like. You know, having a dog in the neighbourhood means you meet more people. There's lots of ways in which our lives with animals can be improved, you know, by having them. So we pretty much know that letting young people access and engage with nature and animals at our site, which has a private woodland nature reserve, we know that that can improve attitudes and behaviours towards the natural environment and the animals that live there. But what we're interested in is, you know, moving them along and understanding that. Because what has become interesting to us was not the fact that we can increase somebody's empathy, but how that actually happens, that sort of process itself, the factors, the influences and the events that bring about that sort of transformation. And for some young people, it's been very significant transformations that we've seen. And actually, for some staff, it's almost been moments of epiphany for them in their own understanding, because we've seen such interesting things taking place. And I've broken this down, really, into a few different themes. So one of the factors that emerged strongly from our research as important in this process of change was the idea of relationships. And I've picked out just three of the factors to talk about today, because there's quite a lot of other things that impact on how people can increase in empathy, it seems to me, at any rate. But relationships was one of the most important ones that we came across. And this is relationships with peers, so with other people in the group that you're coming in, and it's also relationships with our staff members, and it is also relationships that are built up with perhaps peripatetic animals that might be passing through, and so on. So it's a complicated one, the idea of relationships. But I'm just going to use the next slide to illustrate some of the relationships that have been formed and that we've kind of watched unfolding before us. Now, this photo here shows what was probably the contraceptive event of the century, in fact. This was the day that our youth group met our young parents group. How hard work it is for a toddler. And they look happy now. But it all changed later on. So we try to, you know, do all kinds of radical things. But what we've discovered from, you know, taking young people, taking young parents, taking young children out into our woodland nature reserve, where they may or may not see any animals, depending on how loud and scary they are, is that this not only makes them share their stories, I mean, the RSPCA logo itself is something that invites people to share their stories quite frequently, but that being outside as well changes the dynamic. You don't have to look somebody in the eye to have a conversation. You can be looking at a campfire. There's a more convivial sort of sharing atmosphere, and these stories start to come out. And we've seen all sorts of stories, and along the way, stories across time, because we tend to work with people for 6 weeks, up to about 2 years, potentially, with some of the people that have come in. So I'm just going to read you some little vignettes about spiders, just to illustrate some of the things that people have said. Generally, they all start from quite similar positions with regards to spiders, and so this will just illustrate pretty much everything. I can't warm to spiders, but I want to come here and get over this. The bigger ones are more scary. You can hear them making a scuttling noise. And there was a scuttling noise. But the friendliness here gives me confidence, and I can share that with my daughter. So people felt that having peers around them to sort of share the horror gave them more confidence, and then they would start to look at the spider out of the corner of the eye. They'd start to watch the spider and gain a little bit more of an understanding of it being a living animal. They didn't have to like it. We were just asking them to try and respect it a little bit and not stamp on it. People said, I'm still petrified of spiders, but I hide it better now for my child. So they were keen not to pass on these fears. Another person said, spiders creep up on you. In the woods here, you can leave the spider, but in my bedroom, I have to stay there. I had a friend with a pet tarantula, and when I stayed in her room, I did not get a bit of sleep. I had to keep my eye on it all the time, just in case. There's all sorts of stories of people being bitten by spiders, which I'm a bit suspicious of, but it doesn't actually matter whether any of these stories are true or not. I think they indicate people's views. So, you know, the more fictional, the better in a way. I quite liked this one here on the screen, which was about a child who previously would have been scared of spiders, but her mum said, God, it's all hello, Mr. Spider now. And she's ever so thoughtful, we have to move them from here and move them from there. She was exasperated by the care and attention of her daughter because it was taking so long every day. It couldn't get out the door. So, I mean, in summary, really, there was a lot of fear, but there were sort of two overarching intentions and things here. One is that people could learn to moderate their feelings with help from others. Those relationships were key. And that they could tolerate the presence of spiders more now and be more considerate towards them, be more thoughtful. Somebody said, I can let the spider get on with its business, whatever that business may be. So my next one is still relationships, but this is about badgers, which is surprisingly terrifying. If I saw one, I would scream and leg it. Was quite a lot of people's summary of, you know, what would happen if me and a badger met. And this is where the sort of idea of the reality of stories comes in quite strongly, because there seem to be lots of what I would call, from my perspective, urban legends about badgers. A badger that attacked at 3 a.m. A badger that cornered my mum. The badger that almost had me by the throat. There was a lot of nearly and almost and as if. Yeah. The badger never got anybody really by the throat. It was a bit disappointing, but nearly every time. And, you know, people say, well, they can be quite friendly, but they can turn the dark side. And I would be scared. What was interesting was we were taking groups out doing badger watches, and this seemed to be a sort of a transformational event. So people would say, you know, I was scared, but now I've seen them, actually they're quite nice. They make a lot of slurping noises when they're eating, it's quite funny. Also, they can't run very fast, they look a bit silly when they're waddling along. There's a sort of an element of, you know, relating to the behaviours of the badger. And this was really nice because it kind of gave the idea that all the myths are one thing, but when you have your own personal first-hand experience, even from a distance, we're not talking about cuddling badges here, you know, there was a chance to change your mind. And the sort of strong and trusting relationships that people built with staff and friendships that kind of gave them the opportunity to see the badgers, gave them that confidence. And several people said, oh, well, I did think they were vicious, but then one of the staff here told me they were just protecting, you know, themselves. Now I understand it. So understanding sort of led to empathy. Now my second factor is the senses. And you can see here, child on a farm, strangling a sheep, stroking a sheep. The senses seem to be really important. The sort of sights and smells and sounds of animals was a way of engaging with those animals, which we picked up on as quite a strong and important thing. Animal beauty, which I know was mentioned with the salmon yesterday, we saw animals firmly divided into two camps. The nice ones looked nice, owls, monkeys, lemurs, dolphins, horses, polar bears, all the things you're never really going to meet very often. And then the ugly, scary ones, the spiders, worms, the seagulls, the pigeons. And their attractiveness was important in how people felt about them. Did they think they were worthy animals? Did they recognise their sort of bodiness, their aliveness as something worth recognising? But what we found going out in the woods with groups was that the more animals they saw, even if only for a fleeting glimpse, you know, a fox's tail whisking off into the bushes, the more they liked them. And we felt that it showed experience, even if only sort of first-hand visual experience, gave young people a window into the animal's world. And that sort of inspiration, that awe, that wonder, gave them a bit more affection. Sometimes they didn't even have to see the real animal. Evidence such as tracks and signs, poo, footprints, and even the use of soft toys could have a similar impact, which was very good, because I have to say, it is quite hard to see wild animals out in the wood with a bunch of screaming toddlers. Luckily, the soft toy fox is just as good. So, feeling animals, I know this has been talked about quite a bit over the last day and a bit, but this was something that people mentioned a lot. Not that they spent much time doing that with us. This is actually my puppy, Frank, getting a bit of a interaction there with one of our youth, with her young parents and her child. But touch or imagined touch was very important. But there was a clear differentiation between sort of good and bad touch. The dogs, cats and guinea pigs and other pet type animals were seen as cuddly and comforting. Spiders and worms, they were bristly, they were slimy, sort of the unpleasant touches. And it was interesting how people sorted animals into categories like that, by the look, by the feel, by the smell. But physical contact itself was powerful, and I'll just try and sum up an encounter really quickly for you, which was a couple of boys that came to us as part of a conditional caution. Their crime was playing football with a hedgehog, and we spent some time with them, obviously going through what they'd done, and then we gave them a chance to do some work in the wildlife centre, cleaning out some hedgehogs, feeding some hedgehogs. And there, where the touch was with the hands and not the feet, there was a very different relationship that they were able to have with that hedgehog. Obviously, we didn't let them kick our hedgehogs. But so they were using their hands and they were experiencing the hedgehog in a different way than they had with football boots on. And we found that that almost sort of gave them the chance to have that emotional journey that we couldn't have when they were this high above the hedgehog and just, you know, kicking it. And it was a sort of other thing then. It was an object. But in the hand, it became something very different. So the last element of change, that one of the factors that feeds into this empathy building that I want to quickly talk about, is the idea of the emotions, emotional engagement, and how that can raise empathy for animals. So in our woods, it's very peaceful and quiet, and there's sort of time and there's mental and physical space to think about your own personal animal geography, that idea of sort of mapping out where are animals in my life, which is often much more than we think there is once we start to unpick where all the animals are in the different aspects of our home life, school life, work life, transport life, and so on. And this is a very powerful stimulus to emotional engagement when people start to realise just how much impact they have on animals' lives and how much impact animals have on their lives. And so in the course of our activities on visit, which are skill-based, play-based, or all focused on sort of trusted communication, we have time to listen and time to talk. And as was mentioned with fish yesterday, sometimes the sort of not talkingness of animals helps young people relate and connect and build that rapport. So it's not actually always about the talking, it's about the silence quite often as well. So here's somebody, made a little nest. This boy made a nest for that toy bird, and he said, bird happy. He thought the bird was safe and sound and secure there. That he was projecting his understanding of what he needed really on there. And I have to say, some of the other children built spas and jacuzzis and cinemas in their animal homes. But I think by tapping into that imagination, they sort of built that personal relationship with the animal. And they did know really that the animals didn't need a cinema. But there was a bit of fun. We allow a bit of fun. And so we let them build a multiplex and a car park. And sharing your feelings, which is something that's cropped up obviously a lot over the last few days. The other aspect of, you know, emotions is the idea of sharing them, of not just keeping them to yourself. We feel that, you know, young people can understand animals better if they're able to share their emotions and try to share whatever the emotions of the animal are, whether, again, you know, whether it's real or not. And just as a little illustration here, we've been working with a boy who was actually, I think his crime was shoplifting on a different day, but on another day, he's a carer for his mum. He needed to go to the shop, which is 2 miles away. So he rode his horse there, tied it up in Tesco's car park, went and did the shopping, came back along the dual carriageway and home. And the work that we were to do with him was really to get him to understand how the horse might have felt about that. And it was a great opportunity because he cared for his horse really well, but he hadn't really thought what the horse thought about it all, and we were able to kind of input to that. Now, this feels a bit like a race through everything, but in the sort of summary of all of this, I would say that this journey towards empathy, some of the elements of it really are around these relationships. It's around engaging the senses, and it's around an emotional enlivenment, if you like, you know, because oftentimes, particularly the disadvantaged young people that we work with, their emotional repertoire is battened down. It's been sort of hidden away. It's been kept under control because of the circumstances in their lives. And so if they can't feel anything, that can be a good thing. And so we've been trying to help them in a little way to access some of those things. So there are more strands than I've had time to mention here, but you can hopefully see some of the threads that we've started to follow in this sort of work in progress. And I just want to finish with a quick story of, I'm going to call him Frank, a young lad who's in our youth group. Now, he had lots of stories to share, and I think most of them weren't very real. But this one must be true because there was physical evidence to support it. He got bitten on his face by a staffy as a child. He has quite a juicy scar on his face. And he's always been scared of dogs. He thinks they're mean. And you can understand it because the area where he lives in Hastings, there was recently a dog attack where a dog injured 10 people. And there's a lot of staffies, pit bull types, we'll call them mastiffs, those kind of dogs around. Him and the youth group decided that they would like to do something about status dogs. They would like to learn about that. And so we took them to a centre where they had a chance to care for, walk, feed some of these dogs. And now he says, dogs aren't all bad. He understands they might be scared of him too, because he saw that for himself when he was walking some of these dogs that have been quite badly abused. When young people start to realise the common ground they share with animals, to me this is the start of empathy. In our wildlife centre, we take a scientific approach and we radio track, we ring, we tag rehabilitated animals to measure their survival as an indicator of the success of our methods. Sadly, we can't radio track our young people and see what they do after they leave our care, but I feel that these stories are in some way the way that we can access their internal relationships with animals, and hopefully we can then use them to understand what we've achieved. Thank you.